William Sook is the chief of the Hazardous Substance Research Branch in the NIEHS Division of Extramural Research and Training. Sook has served since its inception as director of the NIEHS Superfund Research Program, a program established by Congress as part of the reauthorization of Superfund in 1986 that fosters interdisciplinary research approaches to address the problems associated with potentially hazardous environmental exposures. So with that, Bill, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Michelle. Appreciate it. So this is the third session of this series. We will hear from data science experts who are developing tools through NIH-funded grants to establish infrastructure to coordinate data and develop sophisticated approaches to utilize big data to advance our understanding of human health and disease. In the first two seminar presentations, we had individuals who were funded primarily by NOAA, NASA, and the National Science Foundation. So this seminar is going to focus on two programs that are supported by the National Institutes of Health. But before we turn it over to our presenters, I want to do a quick introduction to NIH-funded programs that will be discussed today. The NIEHS Children's Health Exposure Analysis Resource, otherwise known as CHEER, and the NIH Big Data to Knowledge Initiative, these are what we're going to discuss today. In the first presentation, you will hear from Susan Teitelbaum, Patricia Kovach, and Deborah McGinnis, who recently received the CHEER Award. In the second presentation, you will hear from Greg Cooper, Director of the Center for Causal Discovery, which is an NIH-funded Big Data to Knowledge Center of Excellence. So this is our first presenters, Susan Teitelbaum and Patricia Kovach from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and Deborah McGinnis from the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, RTI. Are recent NIEHS CHEER awardees. CHEER is a new program that continues the original intent of the National Children's Study. First, it will advance our understanding of the impact of environmental exposures on children's health and development. Second, it will provide access to infrastructure for adding comprehensive exposure analysis of biological samples to existing epidemiological and clinical studies involving research in children's health. Nearly $144 million in new grants will develop tools and measures for investigating environmental exposures from the womb through later years in a child's life. Exposure measured by CHEER will encompass the breadth of the exposome, the totality of biological, psychosocial, and chemical, physical exposures through the use of both comprehensive, targeted, and non-targeted methods of analysis. The main emphasis of these hubs is to provide capacity for targeted analysis using state-of-the-art assays specific to known compounds or stresses, such as the methods used by the CDC National Biomonitoring Program. With a few exceptions, each of these labs are essentially looking at similar target class compounds. These labs will also be conducting untarget analysis, measuring biological response indicators, and will include a developmental core to develop and validate new methods for future analytical services. So Second, the Data Repository Analysis and Science Center, or Data Center, is a data and analytics support service resource providing a repository for all providing data for all data and support analytical services and interpretation. This resource will also lead the development of community-based data standards and support the development of technologies and metadata standards. This is the center we will hear from today. Third, the coordinating center provides administrative management of the resource, including an interface to the research community and an index of additional exposure analysis tools not included within the CHEER infrastructure. The main access to CHEER will be through the coordinating center, which will provide pre-application consulting services in support of study design analysis, as well as development and oversee a proposal process. These research projects funded with fiscal year 2015 dollars are designed to provide researchers with an expanded range of tools to accurately measure, record, and analyze environmental exposures. Greater accuracy will help improve our understanding of how these exposures change human biology to affect child health and development. The research will continue to inform programs aimed at developing strategies to reduce the risk of childhood illnesses and disabilities. Greg Cooper, who will be presenting in the latter portion of the webinar, is a member of the Center for Causal Discovery at Pittsburgh, an inaugural member of the NIH Big Data to Knowledge, otherwise known as BD2K Consortium. NIH launched the BD2K initiative in 2012, a trans-NIH initiative that aims to support research and development of innovative tools to maximize the integration of big data and data science into biomedical research. The BD2K Centers program has established 11 centers of excellence for big data computing and one center that is a collaborative project with the NIH Common Fund, LINCS program. The LINCS BD2K Perturbation Data Coordination and Integration Center, don't you just love the government? The centers are located all across the United States. They are large-scale projects aiming to develop new approaches, methods, software tools, and related resources. The centers will also provide training to advance big data science in the context of biomedical research. The 12 BD2K centers function with the other BD2K grantees as a consortium and collaborate with one another, with the purpose of furthering every aspect of the field of biomedical data science research. The ability to harvest the wealth of information contained in biomedical big science, big data, will advance our understanding of human health and disease. The BD2K initiative has five main points of emphasis: sustainability, how to maintain a vibrant research infrastructure driven by data, digital data, at a time when budgets are flat, yet data are growing at an unprecedented rate; training, supporting the workforce of tomorrow when biomedical research increasingly relies on computational, mathematical, and statistical analysis and beyond. Innovation, through the BD2K initiative, stimulating the best developments in the data science community. Process. Refining NIH internal processes to make the most of the data revolution. Finally, communication. Breaking down barriers to new initiatives as data has no boundaries as defined by national or funding or agency funding. This webinar series explores challenges and opportunities for integrating data sets to solve complex environmental health problems. I'll do it from here. We are having this webinar series to begin the conversation about how we might accomplish this. This map of publications from the SRP, Superfund Research Program, shows Superfund Research Program publications distributed based on the journals that publish the work. Those of you who have been a part of this series from the beginning or have followed it through the archive know that I've presented this same slide before. This is an important slide because this diversity of research across the science spectrum helps to illustrate the diversity of data being generated by the program. Here are a few questions we need to address to begin moving toward integrating data. These questions emphasize the need for data sharing, which is an NIH priority. Data sharing is essential for expediting translation of research results into knowledge to improve human health. Today, we will hear from speakers that are developing ways to establish infrastructure to share and coordinate data with the ultimate goal of protecting human health and reducing the burden of disease.
Thank you, Bill. Hopefully that gives you all a good feel for the two major programs whose presenters you will hear from today. First, we're going to hear a team presentation for three of the members of the CHEER program. First, we'll hear from Susan Teitelbaum and Patricia Kovach from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and Deborah McGinnis from the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, her recent NIH Children's Health Exposure Analysis Resource, or CHEER, awardees. Their CHEER data repository, the CHEER Data Repository Analysis and Science Center will address methodology for combining data from a wide range of environmental health studies. Susan Teitelbaum is an associate professor in the Department of Preventive Medicine at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Dr. Teitelbaum is an epidemiologist whose research interests include endocrine disruptors, early puberty, and their relationship to breast cancer risk. She is also part of the NIHS EPA, Mount Sinai's Children's Center for Health and Prevention, and the Mount Sinai Breast Cancer and Environment Research Center. Also speaking during this session is Patricia Kovach, who is the founding associate dean for scientific computing and associate professor at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. At Mount Sinai, Ms. Kovach established a scalable and sustainable high-performance computing infrastructure, emphasizing a collaborative approach, partnering computational experts with Mount Sinai's scientists to tackle complex scientific questions to better diagnose and treat disease. Prior to joining Mount Sinai, Kovach built and led the $75 million National Institutes for Computational Sciences at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, located at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Finally, Deborah McGinnis is the Tetherless World Senior Constellation Chair and Professor of Computer and Cognitive Science at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. She is also the founding director of the Web Science Research Center at RPI. Dr. McGinnis's primary research includes work on explanation, trust, ontologies, e-science, open data, and semantically enabled schema and data integration. Prior to joining RPI, Deborah was the acting director of the Knowledge Systems Artificial Intelligence Laboratory and senior research scientist in the Computer Science Department of Stanford University. So we are going to have all three of these women who will be presenting in succession starting now. So I will take it over to you, Susan.
Okay, thank you so much. I'd like to thank the organizers of the NIEHS Superfund Research Program and EPA's Contaminated Site Cleanup Information Group for inviting us all to speak today. As an environmental epidemiologist who's been investigating the role of the environment on children's growth and development, the opportunity to be involved in the Children's Health Exposure Analysis Resource, which from now on I will refer to as CHEER, was a perfect extension of the research that I've been doing for the past 12 years. I, along with my colleagues who will be speaking shortly, were recently awarded a grant from NIEHS to run the data center, and the official name is the CHEER Center for Data Science, for the CHEER program. And you've heard Dr. Sook really gave a good introduction, and so I'm gonna present similar information, but I'll do it quickly so you won't get too bored. So I've designed my presentation for those of you who are unfamiliar with CHEER, since it's so new and it's currently in its formative year. So in today's webinar, I'm going to give you an overview of CHEER's objectives, the components of CHEER, a description of our data center, and an example of how the CHEER network is going to be working. So, CHEER objectives. Many studies conducted in the past or in the field that are in the field today have not been designed to consider the full array of environmental exposures that may affect children's health and well-being. So NIEHS established CHEER, and it's going to continue the intent of the National Children's Study, and it will advance our understanding of the impact of the environment on children's health and development. CHEER has some very clear objectives. First, we want to increase the number of children's health studies that are including environmental exposure analysis. We're supporting exposome-based research, a concept that's gaining momentum in the environmental health arena. Exposome can be defined as the totality of the environmental exposures from conception through development. And through the state-of-the-art environmental exposure assessment laboratories, CHEER hopes to incorporate the exposome concept into children's health studies. As studies that become part of CHEER analyze their biologic samples, we intend to create a national resource that provides the public with access to children's environmental health exposures. And CHEER will also work towards increasing the efficiency and the effectiveness of conducting and combining children's environmental research through the development of data and metadata standards. So CHEER is made up of three main components: the National Exposure Assessment Laboratory Network, the Coordinating Center, and the Data Center. The National Exposure Assessment Laboratory Network is a network of laboratories that are going to be providing access to state-of-the-art infrastructure for analyzing biological samples as well as understanding biological responses associated with those exposures. There were six different laboratories funded to perform these analyses for CHEER, and they're listed here. The next component is the Coordinating Center, which is being run by WestAt. The Coordinating Center will provide administrative management to the resource, and it will be the main access point to CHEER for the scientific community. The Coordinating Center will oversee the proposal process for studies that would like to become a part of CHEER, and they'll also provide pre-application consulting services in support of study design and analysis for investigators who intend to apply. Additionally, the Coordinating Center will interface with the greater research community. And the final component is the Data Repository Analysis and Science Center, for which I am the principal investigator. And now I'm going to give you a more detailed description of the work that we do, but our data center basically will provide a resource for data and analytics support. CHEER is a cooperative agreement, and it's between the various institutions that were funded under the CHEER mechanism and NIEHS. So we're also going to have a steering committee that's composed of the principal investigators of the CHEER components, along with other key investigators, as well as program officers and others from NIEHS. Additionally, there's an external scientific advisory panel that will be created to provide guidance and advice to all of the CHEER investigators. So the data center is a joint effort between the Icahn School of Medicine and Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. We will be the data and analytics support for the CHEER network, and we will do this by providing a repository for all data that is generated through the laboratory network, as well as all of the other study data that is provided by the principal investigators of the studies that are part of CHEER. And through the data center, investigators will have access to our advanced statistical analysis team, who will be available to collaborate with investigators on statistical analysis and the interpretation of the data that's generated through CHEER. And our team will lead the development of community-based data standards, and we will support the development of technologies and metadata standards. So I'd like to show you a little bit of the structure of our data center. The CHEER Data Center will advance the overarching goal of the CHEER network to provide access to tools that incorporate and extend exposure analysis on an exposome scale. The administrative core will provide overall administration and organizational oversight and management of the data center. The core will also serve as the primary interface between the data center and other units of the overall CHEER network. The administrative core incorporates an internal expert advisory committee, and this group comprises distinguished Mount Sinai scientists who have expertise in areas that are critical to the success of the data center. It includes experts in human subjects research, environmental lab methods, environmental epidemiology, data science, vocabulary, and pediatrics, and they will be available to provide input and guidance as needed. So the data center is made up of three cores. The first is the Statistical Services and Methods Development Resource, and that is directed by Dr. Chris Jennings, who's a professor in our Department of Preventive Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. This resource will provide the relevant statistical methodology to support and to promote the use and impact of exposure data by collaborating with the diverse researchers. The statistical methods and study designs for analyzing complex, high-dimensional data that arise from the exposure studies require advanced knowledge of statistical techniques, and our statistical center has the expertise and the means to be able to do this. Additionally, the core will conduct novel and innovative biostatistical and bioinformatic methods development in areas that are relevant to CHEER and the data center. The next core is the Data Repository and Management Core. Patricia Kovach is the director of this, and she'll be speaking to you next and give you more details about that core. And the third core is the Data Science Resource. Deborah McGinnis, who was introduced, is the director of this resource, and she will be speaking after Patricia, and she'll give you all the details on that core. So the four cores and resources not only work to achieve each of their specific objectives, but they work, all of our work is interdependent, and it requires a great deal of communication and collaboration across the board. So to accomplish this, together the leaders of the data center components form an executive steering committee, and we're responsible for reviewing the activities of the data center and making decisions on any major issues that arise. And so now, this is my final slide. I just want to give you an idea of how workflow will occur through CHEER. So children's health research studies will apply to become part of the CHEER network, and the application process will be administered by the coordinating center. Once accepted, a study will be assigned to one or more laboratories where their biological samples will be analyzed. The analyses offered by each of them include targeted analyses, untargeted analyses, and biological response. Depending on the aims of the CHEER study, they may get results from some or all of these areas. The data will then be submitted to the data center, where it will be placed in our data repository and linked with other study-related data that has been provided by the study investigator. The study investigators will then work with the data center to conduct data analyses that will address their hypotheses. So, now I'd like to turn the controls over to Patricia Kovach, the director of the data center's Data Repository Management Corps. Thank you so much for your attention.
Hello, this is Patricia. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Again, thank you for inviting us to talk. It's really exciting to be part of this, and this is my first webinar, or at least being on this side of it, so it's extra exciting for me. I'm leading the Data Repository and Management Core for CHEER. And as part of this, we will be establishing a repository for the collection, curation, display, storage and retrieval, and the reuse of all the data that's collected from all the studies. So the data, we expect the data will be coming in from individual PIs across the country, but also from the lab network. And so we'll be establishing a data submission pipeline with the lab network, and of course establishing a user-friendly portal so that the folks from the lab network and the individual PIs that will be uploading data can in fact upload their data, and we can put it in this repository. And we're going to be deploying this and designing it using our experience working operating the World Trade Center Health Program Data Center, and also our experience in operating other national data centers. Here at Mount Sinai, we also have a high-performance computing facility that we have over 12,000 compute cores and 160 terabytes of flash and 11 petabytes of storage. And so it's operated not just for folks at Sinai, but for folks across the country. So we have experience in doing that. And of course, you know, all the technology is just, they're just tools to enable the science. So we are very conscious of that, and we want to make sure that the tools that we're designing and deploying are useful. And so, of course, we'll be working closely with the data science piece with Deborah, you know, within our data center, and also on statistical tools and other things, but then also throughout the CHEER network. So working with the individual PIs and the lab networks to streamline the process and protocols for the data sharing, doing the account validations, and just to make sure, like I said, that whatever we deploy is going to be useful and effective for researchers. And we'll also engage with the other scientific advisory boards. We're also planning to have a user engagement board and a data quality assurance board to make sure that the data that we're uploading follows certain standards. And in fact, the working groups and everything have already been started to look at the different metadata standards and some of this and these other things. And also, of course, engaging nationally. So one of the things that we're also going to be doing is linking to other national databases so that high-dimensional data from other databases, such as the Comparative Toxigenomics Database, dbGaP, EPA's AIR data database, can all be integrated with the data that we'll be collecting as part of CHEER. And on this slide, you can see kind of like a high-level overview of some of the functionality that we expect. So we see that we expect to be able to provide. So you'll see the lab networks, researchers and collaborators. These are all kind of different communities of people that we expect will be uploading and downloading data and doing some searches. So we'll have a tool for doing the data upload. We'll also have another tool for doing de-identified searches of the data that are contained in our database. In our data warehouse, and also we'll have the ability to create specific data sets or data marts for people who, for researchers or others who are looking for certain cohorts of data, like repeated cohorts of data that they'll need. And then, of course, we'll have a ticketing system so we can keep track of all the requests coming in, and wiki so that different researchers can share information amongst themselves, and ways to have meetings in Google Docs to share documents and all the and chats and all the other kinds of things that are all the other kinds of functionalities that are kind of standard today to help researchers collaborate. And so in the first year we'll be setting up you know the different policies and things with the account validation and data sharing, developing and deploying the web portal, the ticket system, the data ingest tool, and the data warehouse, and the cohort query tool. You know, of course, testing all of this stuff with the lab network and other friendly researchers out there. And then, of course, developing the training videos and documentation so people can use the infrastructure as easily and as self-service as possible. So. And I think that's my last slide. So I'll thank you again for your time. So I'll hand it over to Deborah.
Thanks, Patricia. Can people hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Excellent. So I would like to just echo my thanks, just like my other collaborators, thanks for letting us be here, and thanks for connecting to us with you, because one of the things I'm going to suggest at the end is you all might have some really good input that we'd like to leverage. So I'm Deborah McGinnis, and I run the Data Science Core within this program, and I'll tell you a little bit about what we're doing. First, I just took the language from the call. Basically, the piece that I lead is tasked with coming up with the data and the metadata standards to support the integration of all this work. And so we'll build what we need to, but our goal is to leverage as much of the data and metadata standards that are out there that are good, that are appropriate for the work. And so part of my task is finding that, and part of my task is understanding where it's appropriate and where the gaps are. And we're leading a community of stakeholders. So we're doing this work, of course, within the portion of the program that I lead, but also reaching out to the rest of the data science team, and reaching out to the rest of the CHEER team, and reaching out to the broader community. So we're kicking off a working group that will be co-chaired by Patricia and myself. And because I'm in charge of the ontology and the vocabulary, but Patricia is in charge of the repository, and so she needs to integrate that vocabulary and standard and also enforce the policy. So we'll be doing this together. We need to scope this work somehow, and the best way the best practice is to scope by use cases. So we need to identify and prioritize the use cases that we'll be that we'll be supporting first in this effort. And then we're also managing the iterative process of developing the use cases and developing the ontologies. And actually, I provided the link to the program, although you already heard a nice introduction. So I don't know how many people on this call might have been familiar with ontologies prior to this talk, but basically, the most quoted definition of an ontology is a specification of conceptualization. So however you think about a topic like exposure, and then how you're going to specify that in a way that a computer can understand. A lot of people find that definition a little squishy. So what we typically teach is an ontology contains a rich description of the terminology, like exposure and child, and like how old is a child, you know, goes up to X years, and the relationships between the terms, the concepts and the individuals, and then the sentences distinguishing the concepts. So what's the difference between an infant and a child, for example? And I don't know whether, do you see my pointer? Maybe not. But on the left side of the spectrum is kind of the least expressive thing that people call ontologies. And actually, the spectrum came out of a panel that I was on in 1999, actually, from the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, where a number of us ontology experts got together and decided what we would count as ontologies and what we wouldn't count. And so the generous definition is just a catalog of terms, so just a limited vocabulary. So you're just going to use the following 1,000 terms or something. And then it gets more and more expressive to natural language definitions, moving to the glossary, to a more formal thesaurus kind of definition, and then out to more and more structured information. And the paper at the bottom gives examples of every single point on this this spectrum. And we'll be designing a family of ontologies that will be used in this program, much of which we're going to be leveraging from best practices, ontologies and vocabularies that are already out there. And we're doing this with a use case approach. This is best practice from almost every perspective that I'm aware of. We didn't come up with this approach. NIH has already validated it in a number of workshops, for example, the keynote, or one of the keynotes at the BD2K. I think this was the kickoff, but one of the early meetings was actually given by my co-author of our Semantic Web Use Case-Driven Methodology. And actually, some people had already done some nice homework for us. I provided some links of that came out of a meeting that NIEHS ran in January of 2015 that gives more information about some of the things that will be driving us. So I co-authored this semantic e-science methodology with a colleague about 12 years ago or something, the first one, and it's been used in a lot of different science, large science interdisciplinary projects. It all starts with the use case, what are you trying to do, works very early on with small teams with interdisciplinary mixed skills, and evaluates constantly. So you you basically define a use case and you look at how you're going to evaluate that. You come up with your mixed team and you figure out how they're going to do their evaluation, and then you go around the circle with analysis, building the ontology, using tools, and iterating. And I've provided links to some papers that have a lot more details on this methodology. So we've started collecting some of the use cases either that NIEHS and their workshops have provided or that some of our internal team members have provided. We've reached out to some of the other labs. Oh, and everyone has already mentioned this program is very new. The kickoff meeting is actually in, I guess, a week and a half. But we've already reached out to the lab members to try to start getting their use cases. And we've done some homework already on a number of vocabularies and ontologies that we think we want to depend on. Both RPI and Mount Sinai have worked extensively with a lot of the foundational vocabularies and ontologies. This is just a tiny list of what's out there to build on as a starting point. And then we use this approach of a concept mapping approach. So basically, we come up with the terms that we need to define. This was from a related project that looked at issues around gestational age and growth. And we come up with the terms that we need to define. We see where it's connected out into well-vetted ontologies. This was just a small set of appropriate ontologies. And then we put it into a formal language that will be driving a lot of those services that were on Patricia's slides of like the access and search. So this program will have the Data Standards Working Group that's kicking off officially at the kickoff meeting, although we've had a couple of planning meetings on that. We also are having some workshops that will be populated by key people within the program, but potentially some of the people listening to this call, to try to help us. What we do is we kind of iteratively identify the starting point vocabularies that we need. We figure out how we're going to glue them together. We figure out what the gaps are. We figure out a plan to fill those gaps. We come up with drafts. We run them by some very friendly experts, and then we push it out kind of iteratively to larger and larger communities to get more and more comments back. And we do it. Oh, and actually, this will all be public. We're going to publish it to all the appropriate places. We'll have it on our website. We'll have it on resources such as BioPortal that contain a lot of ontologies that are relevant to this work. The ontologies are browsable. We'll have them in a lot of different forms, like the concept map that I just showed, as well as other kinds of depictions. We will have it up on our wiki that will support a number of different kinds of input. And although I lead this as an ontology expert, I have co-leaders within just the core that I run, within the statistical community and within the epidemiology community, so that we've got a transdisciplinary approach, and the goal is to have leadership be able to speak the vernacular of pretty much everybody who contributes. And there's a lot of linkages to a lot of active communities. For example, I lead the ontology effort within the Healthy Birth, Growth, and Development Knowledge Integration Program that the Gates Foundation is running, and there's a tremendous amount of overlap with the ontology work on that. Then we've got a process that's evolving. So where do we get our starting points? We work on coming up with the use cases, and actually we will solicit them, we are soliciting them from the members of the CHEER program. we look for the kinds of driving questions that they're trying to answer and then what kind of data they need to get to answer those questions, and potentially more importantly, what kind of data needs to be integrated so that you can answer those questions. And you're not going to be able to integrate that data unless you understand what the data is talking about. And for example, if somebody defines an infant who is up to 6 months and somebody else defines an infant up to a year, then you're going to have mismatches when you try to integrate that data. So we take in information from the use cases. We look for existing ontology and vocabulary resources. We look for existing well-defined operational definitions. We look at, and so the top three are kind of top-down approaches as input. The next one, the database schemas and the data dictionaries. What kind of data do we already have that that we expect is going to go into this repository? What kind of database schemas do we expect to go in? And so that's kind of a bottom-up approach. What kind of vocabulary is the data already using? And then we also talk to experts about the breadth and depth that we really need to be representing. We're doing that within our internal team and then within the broader community. And so we take these resources that come in that help us identify the terms that we've got to teach to the computers and teach to the resources so that they can talk together. And then what we've done in really big interdisciplinary programs such as this, we know, despite the fact that I love using ontology browsers and editors, a lot of practicing scientists might not, and we've had a lot of luck working with a spreadsheet-based input system since almost every scientist who collects data is comfortable or at least uses spreadsheets. And so we take input in a lot of different ways, and we take that into spreadsheets, and then from the spreadsheets, we've got automated tools that generate the ontologies, and then we use the ontology tools to check for consistency and check for linkages. And then we've got tools such as an ontology browser that let you not see the underlying representation, because a lot of people don't want to see the geek speak that my colleagues, you know, that my computer science colleagues want to write this stuff in, but that let you see how the terms interrelate and then let you put comments in about that that would help us refine it. So we've got a couple of the tools already in at least prototype stage for the browsing mechanisms. And then for people who don't like using tools, we actually will also work with reviewers and curators on an interview kind of basis to help us refine these ontologies. And then, of course, we're integrating that in with the knowledge base and the repositories, and we're providing tools. So we'll provide kind of deep semantic tools that help you find things that you're related to that you might not have used the exact word for, and then those prototype tools will get into the tools that Patricia was mentioning that the outside world sees. And this is my last slide other than acknowledgments. Some things that potentially people in the audience might want to provide us are use cases that help identify the vocabularies and ontologies that we should be connecting, pointers to those ontologies, evaluations of vocabularies and ontologies, and pointers for who might help us evaluate. And we definitely didn't do this in isolation. These are the key contributors to the first part is my team local to RPI. The second part is the team local to Mount Sinai, and we had a lot of input from NIEHS. So with that, maybe we should open it for questions.
Great. Thank you very much. Those are great presentations and a lot to think about and a lot of information that was presented. I'd encourage anybody who has a question to please submit it through the Q&A chat box. And I believe, Sarah, we can also let them unmute their lines, too, if they want to ask a question live.
If you are on the phone line, then you can press #6 to unmute your line and ask a question. If you are just listening in via the computer, you will need to type in the Q&A box.
Okay, so as people are considering what questions they might want to ask, I encourage you to, we'll go through the phone lines first. I tend to sort of neglect them, so let's do those first. But as people are thinking, I had one question, and this might be a little bit of a naive question, so please pardon it. As you're developing these ontologies and making these connections, what happens when there's a new avenue of science that gets discovered? So, you know, so for instance, microRNAs, no one knew that they existed, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and they now we're seeing that there's such a level of regulation. How do they get incorporated, or do things have to be rewritten?
That's a great question, and that leads us to the point that ontologies are living, breathing objects. Even once you've run it through all of your expert review and you actually have consensus on definitions, which actually takes a lot of work, there's always something new coming up. And so we basically look for that input when a scientist says, hey, you know, I'm studying a new thing, and by the way, the new thing is called X microRNA, and often, but by the time that it reaches the computer scientist, somebody has already defined at least kind of a database schema for what they're collecting. So often, even in very new areas, there's often some starting points for the vocabulary. And so we look to see what the starting points are. Sometimes those starting points might be just be, I'm investigating the following three questions, and then what term, basically what noun phrases are in those questions, so what terms am I going to have to teach the computer? And then I need to figure out for any new term, like microRNA, I'm going to go back to you, say you're the person who brought this up. I'm going to go back to you and say, well, how does that relate to other terms in my ontology? Is it strictly more specific than something? Is it a whole new branch? So I look for what those relationships are, and then I work with experts to try to define those relationships and make sure that they're clear. And then typically, we don't have a single monolithic ontology. We've got a number of modules. So we might have this microRNA module that connects in to the overall, you know, biological upper echelon kind of ontology. And so you can, you know, maybe for a bunch of people who are not studying microRNA, they don't want to pull in that ontology and, like, increase the cognitive overload. So I didn't bring up the modularization aspect, but that that will be prominent because the way that you really – so I've been running ontology divisions for 25 years, I guess. And the way that you really increase your ontology reuse is to have these small bite-sized pieces that people can get their head around instead of having one big monolithic thing.
I'm glad I asked that. Thank you. That's actually really good information to know, and we'll definitely be following you guys as you progress to this program. I, again, encourage people, if you have any, if you want to ask a question through phone, just star to unmute, star six, or pound six to unmute your line. And as we're waiting for questions to come through, we had someone that came through, and this question, I believe, should be directed to Susan. So the question is, can you speak a bit about preliminary plans for protecting data privacy and about managing different levels of access to the data repository? When you say that the repository will be available to the public, does this mean that truly anyone can access it? Will there be any requirement that individuals accessing data be associated with an institution?
Those are all excellent questions, and they are first and foremost in my mind with respect to getting CHEER as a working entity. And so this is all right now, as I said, this is our like formative year. And the concept is, although nothing is yet formalized, is that there will be different levels of access depending, first of all, completely guided by the different studies, institutional IRB rulings in collaboration with the IRB rulings from the data center. But the investigator of a study that becomes part of CHEER will, before anything happens, before any data leaves their hands and comes to CHEER, all of the agreements with respect to data sharing will be in place. the concept will be that the full data set that gets deposited into the repository would only be accessible to the investigator and any designees that that investigator may have. Then there will be other levels of access, and those are will all be driven by the rules of the data sharing plan that the investigator has. Our hope is that at some level, there will be some publicly accessible data. And what the detail and the availability of that data set will be is all in a work of progress. So, but the hope is that there will be different levels of access. There will be application processes in order to access the data, depending on the level of information that is approved. It's kind of a convoluted answer, but we are so conscious of data security, privacy, confidentiality, and that will be one of our challenges as well as one of our tasks to do.
Thanks, Susan. That's a great answer. We have another question that's come through the Q&A pod, and this question is directed to Patricia. And the question is, what are your thoughts on how to handle the heterogeneity of data from the laboratory network?
Hi, Kit. Can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can.
Okay. So that's another good question. And part of how we're planning to handle that is by we're going to store the data. So right now we operate, as I said, a data warehouse for the World Trade Center health program and also even just for Mount Sinai. And so we get all different sorts of data in our data warehouse now. So we get like all the Epic medical records, plus we get the different financial information and up from lots of other databases. And so we kind of store everything in, like a generic format inside this data warehouse. So we intend to use a similar kind of approach for this kind of data. I mean, we're still in the early days, and we're trying to understand the different sorts of data that's going to be coming in. But we plan to kind of store everything in a, in a way that's, generic's not the right word, but a way that's not specific to any kind of one data type, so that it's flexible and that we can enable data to be, so that we can connect different sorts of data, so that we're able to connect different sorts of data together, to integrate different sorts of data together at the same time.
Thank you, Patricia. And I'll remind people, too, that this webinar is being recorded, so if you want to view it again to listen to some of these answers, you can certainly do that. Or so this next question, Patricia, I think might also be directed to you. And the question is there specific authentication authorization method that's planned to access the repository?
Yeah, so I would say that we're going to follow, I mean, again, that's because it's early days, we're figuring out some of those things, and it'll be, we'll build on whatever Susan, I mean, we're working on all the different policies now with the coordinating center and all this to figure out how we are going to do that. I mean, certainly if there's a certain data set that's only supposed to be accessed by a certain group of people, that we will make sure that those kinds of access controls are in place so that that is the case. So I think in some sense we're waiting to see what comes out from our working groups in terms of the data sharing policies, but that would certainly be when a researcher uploads the data, that's certainly going to be a step in who do you want this data to be shared with, so that we can figure out how to store it and whether it's searchable on the cohort query tool that would give some information on cohort on de-identified cohorts, so like numbers of studies that were done or numbers of people that were in studies that were done in a, that have to do with, say, air quality or something. So it would be, so we're still figuring those things out, but obviously that'll be an important piece of what we deploy and what we put together.
Thanks, Patricia. This next question is directed, I would think, to Susan. And the question has to do with QC and QA. So how how are the quality control and quality assurance being applied to the data that's coming in terms of reliability, relevance, as it's applied to a specific endpoint?
Well, there's different types of data that will be coming in. The laboratory data, which is new data, it's going to be generated through the CHEER network, will go through its own process of QA and QC through the labs. Obviously, the linkage of the labs will have some metadata that goes with their samples, and when that gets passed to the data center, we'll be able to check that the data that comes in actually matches the data that has already been deposited, existing data from the principal investigator that's been deposited in the repository. One thing I should point out is that the results from the lab data, the lab analyses, are the only new data that is being collected through CHEER. CHEER is going to be built on studies that are existing, have data collected already, have biological samples stored already, and so into the data center repository will be put data that's already from the investigator's side collected, possibly used in other analyses that they've done, and then provided to the CHEER network so that it can be linked with the biological sample data that will be coming in. So we will certainly have a wide range of QA and QC on the data that comes in, plus the investigators will obviously be involved in the whole process for them to review the data and make sure that when we have final data sets that it agrees with the data that they have been using the whole time that they've been in existence.
And I'll just add on, too, that we'll also be doing some checks, too, as data gets uploaded. So some simple checks like what we do now, if we know, for instance, if someone's trying to upload the age of a patient, right, and the number's 300, we know that that's not right, right? So, in fact, the data that gets uploaded will go into some kind of staging area where we'll be able to do some basic checking to see. We'll do some basic error checking to see if what is being uploaded actually makes sense, and then we can go back to whoever's uploading it and say, hey, you know, this doesn't look quite right, you know, before the data actually gets committed to the database, and we'll have a chance to correct it. So, I mean, it obviously would not necessarily find all the problems, but, I mean, it should at least find some obvious stuff. So, yeah, so we have some things like that that we'll be doing to try to ensure data quality and integrity as well.
And this is Deborah. I think we'll also have the quality checks available for people to see. And actually what my team usually does, and I think Patricia's team does too, is we've got a set of things that are clear errors. You know, if you've got somebody living to age 500, clear error. But there are other things that are unlikely. But so they're warnings, not errors. They're unlikely, but not inconceivable. So if you're both a man and a woman, you know, that's today, that's not really biologically impossible, but it's typically an error. So we'd have error kind of checks and warning kind of checks.
Thank you. And Deborah, good that you're on right now. This next question is, I believe, directed to you. And the question is, what are your thoughts on getting community buy-in for domain-specific ontologies?
Oh, what a great question. You know, I constantly am in that situation, and, you know, the strategies are kind of whether you're doing something with a stick or doing something with a carrot. I always like to do something with a carrot, so something like an incentive. So I try to understand how I can help, how an ontology can help somebody do their job better. And so it might be actually with consistency checks, because it's not just the explicit checks, like integrity checks that you see in a database, but it's the implications of things. So if you are consistent with my ontology, I can do what we call a, quote, deductive closure. So I can see many of the implications of the data. So I can kind of help you check, do a sanity check. Maybe you're interested in connecting out to other communities. I can help you make those connections by showing what the relationships are. So I try to understand what people care about to try to incentivize them to come. But also, increasingly, our funders are really caring about us to use vocabularies that other people can understand. So increasingly, funding agencies like NIH, or less NSF, but other governmental agencies, are increasingly strongly suggesting that people are compatible with standardized vocabularies. So we've got people who are almost forced to use the vocabulary. So this is a way for people to be able to contribute a vocabulary and have their positions be heard, rather than having something forced on them. If they want to contribute vocabularies that they think others should use, I might be able to help them have a better life by hearing their needs earlier rather than later.
Thank you, Deborah. Now, this next question, I think it'd be interesting to hear, to get all three of your takes on it, if you can. This question is, will environmental sample data, so example, air sample results, be stored as well as biospecimen results data? And it'd be interesting to hear what you guys might think about integrating this and ontologies for this.
Well, this is Susan. I can start the discussion. So, absolutely, in that any data, like any study that becomes part of the CHEER network will be welcome to deposit any and all data that they may want to be integrated into the whole system. So that if a study has air pollution data, if they have other environmental biomarker data that they've measured already, that data will all be completely acceptable and welcome into the CHEER data repository. And the hope is that we can, as both Dr. Sook and I mentioned, I mean, CHEER is the continuation of the spirit of the National Children's Study, to try to understand as well as we absolutely can the role of the environment in childhood growth and development. So any and all environmental information that exists in these studies that are part of CHEER can be merged into whatever new data might be generated through the network of labs.
And I'll pick up. This is Deborah. We certainly expect a great diversity of terms to be required in our ontology family. And actually, we also expect descriptions of the data analysis to be in there as well. So we expect quite a big breadth, and I think I've got job security.
Okay. Well, thank you. We have one last question that's come through, and as you can tell from the questions that we're getting, there's a lot of interest in your program. And the question is, when is the kickoff meeting?
So our internal meeting, which is the first time that all of the, am I on mute or not mute? Sorry.
We can hear you.
We hear you.
Okay. I couldn't remember if I pushed mute or not. Sorry. So the internal meeting of all of the principal investigators and their important others will occur in November. That's an internal closed meeting. I do not know. I don't know that they've gotten to the point of scheduling something that's external. I think that there's a lot of work that's got to be done to create all the correct connections between the infrastructures that have been funded to make sure that it's all solid and robust to begin the application process for studies that are out there that are doing children's research. And it doesn't have to be just, I want to point this out because I don't think I emphasized it, the research that is being done that would be eligible to be part of CHEER does not have to be environmental research. It has to be children's research where an environmental component can be added and would be excellent to add. So there are studies that are out there that are looking at the environment's role in children's health, but there are also studies out there looking at children's health, but they are not necessarily considering the environment as part of the wide array of exposures that are related to the outcomes. And so those are the kind of studies that are really going to be welcome and CHEER for the addition of environment into their study approach.
Susan, that's an excellent point that you just made, and I'm glad that you stressed that. Thank you. Before we go on to the next speaker, I just wanted to give anyone on the phone who just had a last-minute question the opportunity to ask. If you want to do that, it's *6 to unmute. And while we're just waiting, what I'll say is if you have additional questions that come up, please just be sure to enter them into the Q&A pod. And if we don't have time to get to them after our second presentation and we've run through the questions for that one, we will ask the speakers to follow up with you. So we always try our best to do that. So just give it another few seconds to see if anyone's going to give us a question through the phone line. So with that, we'll get started with our next speaker, who's Gregory Krupper. He's an MD and PhD, a professor of biomedical informatics at the University of Pittsburgh. His research focuses on the application of probabilistic modeling, say that 10 times fast, machine learning, Bayesian statistics, and artificial intelligence to biomedical informatics problems. He is director of the Center for Causal Discovery, which is an NIH-funded Big Data to Knowledge, BD2K, Center of Excellence. It is a collaboration of researchers at the University of Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, the Pittsburgh Supercomputing Center, and Yale University. The center is developing free and open source algorithms and systems to assist biomedical scientists in discovering causal relationships from large and diverse data sets. It is also providing online and classroom training about methods and software for causal discovery. So Greg, thanks again for agreeing to present, and I will leave it over to you.
Okay, thanks, Michelle. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. Yes, thanks for having us. My pleasure. I just wanted to mention that the PIs are shown here. I'm serving as one, Yvette Behar and Jeremy Berg, and we're one of 11 NIH-funded centers of excellence in BD2K. These centers' funding started about a year ago, and there are 3 more years of funding on the current grant. So we have 40-plus scientists who are involved in the center, including those with expertise in computing, in biology, in bioinformatics, and in medicine. So it's quite a team effort. What I would like to spend a few minutes with you talking about are these issues. I want to just give you very briefly a little bit more context about BD2K, and then focus on why we're focused on discovery of causal knowledge from big data. Why did we establish this center, and what are some of the basic methods to give you a flavor for some of the methods that we're using, and then what are the more broad goals that we have for this Center for Causal Discovery. So in terms of the overall national NIH BD2K effort, the Centers of Excellence are part of that effort. It's an initiative that started in 2012. It includes more than a Centers of Excellence, of course. The goal is to develop and disseminate computational methods and training associated with those to help biomedical scientists to use big data to advance biomedical science. And to take quoted material from the website that you can see here at the bottom where you can get a lot more information about BD2K, I'll just read it. Biomedical big data is more than just very large data or a large number of data sources. It is diverse and complex. It includes imaging, phenotypic, molecular, exposure, health, behavioral, and many other types of data. And these data could be used to discover new drugs, for example, or to determine the genetic and environmental causes of human disease. So it's obviously very much on the same wavelength of what this call is about and what you all are interested in doing. So to no surprise, I don't think, of anyone, science is centrally concerned with the discovery of causal relationships in nature. There are other things in science besides causation, such as spatial relationships, but certainly causation is at the core. We'd like to understand how nature behaves, and in large part, in order to be able to predict outcomes, including health outcomes, and be able to control nature, both maintain health and, when disease comes, to be able to find ways of controlling the disease and hopefully eliminating it, removing it. So some examples are to determine the genes and cell signaling pathways that cause breast cancer, to discover clinical effects of a new drug as a causal discovery issue, to uncover the mechanisms of pathogenicity of a recently mutated virus that's spreading rapidly in the population. So why did we then establish this center for causal discovery now? Two main reasons, trends that are converging. One is algorithmic advances, and another is availability of big data. In terms of algorithmic advances, in the past 25 years or so, there's been a lot of progress in developing computational methods for representing causal relationships and for discovering them from a combination of data and background knowledge. And these methods are generally quite applicable to biomedical data. The other main trend is the availability of biomedical big data. There's a variety and a richness and the quantity of such data that are becoming increasingly available. High-throughput molecular data, such as whole genome sequencing data, is becoming much more affordable and almost certainly to be captured much more frequently from individuals and patients in particular. Clinical electronic medical record data is also becoming increasingly available and being captured. And population health data from sources such as social media and mobile sensors. So the appropriate ways of analyzing these data, we believe, have great potential to advance biomedical science, and in particular, analyzing such data for causal relationships. So basically, we felt like the time was right to make these algorithms much more known and available to biomedical scientists in an easy to use way, in a central place that they know to go, that is supported, they get support, and to use this software to analyze biomedical big data to help discover causal relationships. So the basic workflow for our Center for Causal Discovery is we have data and prior knowledge in some domain, and I'll talk about the domains more later. We do a causal analysis using algorithmics that are available through our center. That produces causal networks of relationships, which then lead scientists to form causal hypotheses. Generally, those lead to experiments, and those experimental results go back into the data. And it's a cycle that is probably not surprising to anyone, but is instantiated here to emphasize that this kind of workflow is typically what we're seeing, what we would follow in our causal discovery center. This data, I want to emphasize, can be both observational data, of which there's a lot in both biology and medicine, and experimental data. We can use a combination of those two. So let me go under the hood just a little bit and talk and give you a flavor for what the methodology that we use looks like. There's three main components. One is model representation. We need some way of representing causal relationships. Model search, we need to search over those models to find the ones that are the most supported by the data. And model evaluation, as we're searching over them, we need to evaluate how strong they are supported by the data. So let me talk about them in turn. In terms of representation, we're using primarily a representation called causal Bayesian networks. And in such networks, nodes represent variables. So you see three nodes here, A, B, and C. and arcs represent direct causation. So you see in this diagram that A is being represented as causing B, and B is causing C directly. And these are directed acyclic graphs, and basically the graph, the network, is representing local causation. So in this example, C is independent of A given B, because B is a local cause of C. So if we know the state of B, knowing the state of A gives us no more information about C. So it's a form of local causality that's being represented by these networks. And not only do we represent the structure of the relationships, but we also represent the quantitative aspects of the relationship. So we have a joint probability distribution shown in the bottom here for the example, the joint distribution of A, B, and C. This model factorizes as A, probability A times B given A times C given B. And you can see that this factorization is incorporating the local causation that's implied by this structural model. We need to be able to search over these models, and the space of models is usually very, very large, so we need to do some form of heuristic search that doesn't search everywhere but tries to find the most probable models within the search space of models. And here's an example of search over our three-variable model, A causing B and C not having any direct cause from A or B. Here's one where A is causing B and B is causing C. We saw that before. Here, A and C are causing B. And the the algorithm is essentially searching over these different possibilities and scoring each one of them relative to the data and background knowledge that we give the system. So we're searching over these models. How do we evaluate them? And there's two primary approaches that have been used. One is called constraint-based, and the other is Bayesian. And I only have time to talk about one, so I'm going to talk about constraint-based. And here's the basic idea behind that. So we determine constraints that hold among the variables, and for example, independence conditions based on statistical tests. You know, one variable is independent of another given another set of variables. And we use those patterns of constraints to narrow the causal possibilities. So here's an example of that. Suppose we're searching over causal Bayesian networks, and we apply some statistical tests to observational data on these three variables, and we obtain the following constraints. A and B are dependent. B and C are statistically dependent according to this test, and A and C are statistically dependent. Now, if we look at these two possibilities for the moment, and in general, there would be a lot more possibilities, but let's just look at these two for simplicity. Which of these two is supported by those constraints, those three constraints above? Well, if we look at this one, we see that A, we'd expect to be, in this model, A and B to be dependent because there's a direct causation represented by the model, B and C to be dependent. What about A and C? Well, if transitivity holds, which oftentimes it does, we would expect that to be reasonable to occur as a pattern, A and C being dependent. And we have all three of those here. Let's look at this model. A and B, yes, we'd expect them to be dependent. C and B, yes. But A and C we would not expect to be dependent. They are causes of B, but they have no causal relationship among themselves. So we would expect them to be independent given this model. And in fact, they're dependent. So these three constraints actually support the first model shown here and not the second one. The point I'm making is that these kinds of constraints can help guide which model is generating the data. And it's these kinds of compatibilities between statistical patterns that we're seeing in the data and the models that we're hypothesizing that are driving the search in the direction for models that are consistent with the data. So there's some other kinds of, we've just been talking about the direct causation here in the top row, but we can also imagine that there's hidden variables that intermediate between the measured variables X, Y, and Z, for example. or importantly, there could be hidden variables that are causing the measured variables here. I have H as a hidden variable causing a measured variable X and Y, and we're oftentimes concerned about such confounding as an alternative to causation. Another one that's not often as often discussed is selection, which is the measured variables actually cause the data to be collected in some way. They influence the data collection, which is represented here by S for selection. And that can lead X and Y to be dependent in our data, even though there's no causal relationship between X and Y otherwise. So we have to be concerned. We have to be aware of these possibilities and model them also. There's a lot of other considerations that we need to take into account in our representation and algorithm discovery algorithms. We want to be able to represent prior knowledge. We want to have various types of discrete and continuous variables. There's temporal dynamics that may need to be represented, various distributions between these variables that we'd like to represent. Sometimes representing feedback can be very important, particularly in biology. I mentioned latent confounders and being able to be aware of those and model them, selection bias. And the data sets, we can oftentimes have multiple data sets on the same variables or multiple data sets that only have overlapping variables. And, of course, there's all kinds of issues going back to the ontology discussion where the data sets have partial overlap in their meaning. And so we have to reconcile how to combine those data in order to try to reach causal analytic conclusions. And these are challenging problems, and we haven't solved all these together. We've made progress in solving subsets of them, but we think even that can be provide algorithms that are helpful today. So the types of big data problems that we're addressing are, let me first say that there are several different types of big data problems. One is the volume of data, such as the number of samples or the number of variables per sample, where a sample could be a patient case. The variety of data, different types of data, is another type of big data. The velocity, how fast the data is coming in, is a dimension of big data. The uncertainty in the data, noise and biases, can be another source of causing the data to be complex and in some sense big. We are focused on, let me give you an idea here. We've been able to work and develop algorithms that can deal with dozens of variables even 10 or 15 years ago. More recently, in the last 5 or 10 years, we've been able to deal with hundreds of variables tractably in developing networks from data. We would like to be able to handle tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even more variables, and this is one of the challenges that we're taking on in the Center for Causal Discovery. So one of our main big data problems is to analyze biomedical data sets containing a large number of variables in order to be able to generate plausible hypotheses of the causal relationships that hold among those variables. So that's the number of variables per sample is one of our key goals and areas of focus. We're also looking at the variety of data, different types of data, and the uncertainty in the data as additional areas for big data contributions. The primary aims of our center, then, stepping back, are to develop and implement state-of-the-art computational algorithms to support causal discovery from biomedical big data, and to investigate 4 biomedical projects that are going to test and drive the algorithmic development, and then to disseminate these methods and ideas widely in biomedicine, both researchers and data scientists in biomedicine. We're making software open source and free, freely available, and we also have training about these methods and software online and in person. We have a workshop that will be coming up next June for those of you who are interested, and I'll give you a website that you can track that and register when the registration opens. So we have 4 driving biomedical projects. One is in the discovery of cell signaling networks in cancer. Another is discovery of mechanisms of disease onset and progression in chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. The discovery of essentially the causal connectivity of regions of the human brain from fMRI data, And then we're investigating possible causes and subtypes of autism spectrum disorder. So let me just focus for a few minutes on these two because I don't have a whole lot of time. In the cancer DBP, we're developing methods that identify drivers, disease-causing mutations in individual tumors. And we're using the Cancer Genome Atlas and other data sets for this purpose. Here's some of the cancers, approximately 30 different cancer types that are covered in the TCGA. And you can see the types, some of the types here on the left and the number of cases that are on the right. It's quite a rich resource. If we just look at the breast cancer data that's available, we can see that there's exome data, there's SNP data, over 1,000 cases with SNP data, methylation data, or mRNA data, microRNA data, and clinical data on these cases. So quite a rich diversity of information available, omic and clinical. And we're searching for mutations that the data support is causing changes in cellular behavior of the tumors as a way of trying to find the drivers. And we found many known drivers of cancer so far in analyzing TCGA data, and we found some mutations that are not known to be drivers of cancer, and we're planning to test those in the near term experimentally. The other driving project I wanted to mention is Causal Discovery in the Cloud, and it's a collaboration between our Center for Causal Discovery and the Harvard Picture Center, BD2K Center, and we're developing a proof-of-principle system that's sharing data in the cloud and analytic services to analyze that data. So we're trying to we're in the process of prototyping a way to share in a secure way big data in the cloud, and we're using the Amazon cloud, and put our causal analysis methods in the cloud and be able to analyze the data in the cloud. So as a prototype for understanding how to do this better. And we're using an autism research database developed, funded by the Simons Foundation. It has over 2,500 samples and a rich diversity of data, clinical, genomic, fMRI data, and other types of data. And the biomedical aims are to develop insights into the causes and subtypes of autism. We also have computational aims, which is to make the data available in the cloud, make the algorithms available in the cloud, and then be able to apply the algorithms, as I said, to the data in the cloud. So just to summarize, the NIH BD2K initiative is focused broadly on developing ways to enhance the translation of increasing amounts of digital data into biomedical knowledge. Causal relationships, of course, are central to biomedical knowledge, and our Center for Causal Discovery is focused on developing and making algorithms available and systems available for generating plausible causal hypotheses from big biomedical data. And to do that, we're exploring several biomedical problems that will test and drive the development and the refinement of these causal discovery methods. And finally, I wanted to acknowledge the 40 or more members, scientists, and others in our center who've contributed so far in the first year, and also, of course, to NIH for their support of this work. So thank you. Here is where I can be contacted by my email, and also this is the website for our center, and we have a lot more information and resources there for those of you who are interested. So thank you.
Thanks for a great talk, Greg. I'll just remind everyone, if you have a question, please feel free to submit it through the Q&A pod, or you can take your phone off mute by pressing *6. And as people are contemplating their questions, a few came to mind as you were presenting, and one is one you might expect coming from someone who's working for the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. So I wonder, as you were discussing those hidden variables that can sometimes creep up in your analyses, how do you see environmental factors contributing to disease fitting in to that?
Well, I think the more, you know, variables that we have that plausibly are actually causative, the better it is to include them in the models, because we'd like to avoid having latent variables if at all possible. So if those variables are, in fact, you know, causal, including them will will make the analyses basically more forthcoming in terms of the relationships we'll be able to find. If there are a lot of latent variables, including environmental variables, the algorithms may output fairly conservative relationships because it really can't, from the data it has, distinguish between whether or not something's directly causal or there are latent confounders. And the patterns of relationships leave that level of uncertainty, and therefore, you know, we won't learn as much from the data.
And I'll go out on a limb here and ask you a bit of a naive question, so bear with me. So when you're inputting, you're using the data to come up with these models, I know you're using the TGCA Atlas, which is in a way refined data. So I wonder, you know, how is it different between raw data versus refined data? Do you find that there's a bias, or does it work itself out if you have enough data points?
Well, I mean, I think they, you know, doing causal analyses of the data is similar to doing other types of statistical analyses where the quality of the data and the, you know, having the data cleaned up, the more you can do that, the more you're going to be able to get, robust, trustworthy results from your output. So it's, I think it really is very similar to other kinds of analytic methods in that regard. You really want to try to clean the data up as much as possible. Was that related to your question?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Thank you. A question has come through the Q&A pod, and this is, could you comment more on what resources are dedicated to experimentally validating the resulting models? And the extra part to that is there's a lot of possible causes.
You mean in each of the projects you're talking about?
So I think just the models that you come up with, how are the models validated?
Well, in the case of cancer, for example, we've come up with some hypotheses about drivers of particular types of cancer, such as breast cancer, and we're in that one type of experiment we're doing is using cell lines to try to validate some of those drivers that aren't currently known, using human cell line data. So it depends on the particular project, but largely it's going to be in the lab, some type of laboratory experiment. And so these causal discovery, the word discovery is maybe a little bit optimistic. It's causal focused hypothesis formation, if you will. These algorithms are meant to take the data that we have right now and try to provide high probability hypotheses that are likely to be true but may not be true, but focus our attention, the scientist's attention, much more than they otherwise would be, and allow for more efficient experimentation, more focused experimentation. And the algorithms that we're producing will be successful if the experimental efficiency, is much higher than it otherwise would be.
Okay. This question sort of ties in and builds upon what you've just said. And this is, do you use a standard method to assess the reliability of the studies? For example, something like, now I'm sorry if I pronounce this wrong, the Clemish scoring that assigns a code to each study, reliable with or without restriction, not reliable, et cetera.
I'm not sure I understand the question. Can you rephrase it?
What I'll do is I'll try to rephrase it, and if I could get the person who's asked the question to go ahead and unmute your phone, *6, and that might help clarify the question.
Okay.
The question is just, is there a standard method do you use to assess the reliability of the studies? So something that a scoring that lets you know whether or not something has a high score is deemed as more reliable, and this would give a code to each of the study, reliable, with or without restriction, not reliable. I don't know if that helps at all.
Well, there's okay, so I understand better now. I mean, sort of two-part answer, I guess. One, in generating these models themselves, There's usually the scoring actually provides some prioritization over the models themselves. So in the case of the Bayesian scoring, you have some sort of probability that you can output for the relationships that the algorithm is providing, the causal relationships, and there's a probability associated with those. That's probably not the question that they're asking, but I just wanted to make that point. That's a related point. The point I think they're asking is, once you get a hypothesis that's output by our algorithms, what do you, and you experimentally validate it, is there some sort of standard way for scoring the validation? And I would say no, we don't have some sort of standard way that we're using for scoring the validation. It really depends on the nature of the experiments that you have to do in order to validate the causal hypotheses.
Okay, thank you. I think that does address what she was asking.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a bit more time for some questions, so if anyone else has any other questions, please feel free to put through the Q&A pod, and you can even direct them to the three previous speakers, Susan, Patricia. My goodness, Susan, Patricia, and Deborah. And we'll just give a few minutes just to let any come through. Also, if anybody prefers to ask a question to the phone lines, I would ask you just to press pound six to unmute your line. So we'll just let that go for a few seconds. What I'll do is, as we're waiting to see if any more questions come through the Q&A pod, just say before we conclude, I wanted to make sure that everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. They'll stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtracks. In the near future, you'll receive an email, I think from Jean Ballant, to let you know that the webinar is available and you can view it at your own leisure. Also, in the related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling that online feedback form, because these comments help us provide you with better webinars. We always are trying to improve them, both the content and how the webinar is delivered, so all your feedback is important to us. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's events. So I'd just like to remind the participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN website. There's the EPA Cleanup Technology Facebook page. The EPA Cleanup Technology is also on Twitter. You can follow them there. You can also join the Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN LinkedIn group. And you can also visit the Superfund Research Risky Learning webinars page. And Superfund also has Twitter that you can follow. While we don't have any formal documentations for continuing education credits or related credits for any internet seminars, and do not track our participation in a way that allows us to confirm that you're present for the entire event, we do know that many participants are able to use internet seminars to help their continuing education needs. And if you need confirmation that you participated during today's webinar, please visit the site www.cluin.org/training-records. And that's just right across the top of the slide that you see on your screen now. So I'm just looking to see if there's any additional questions. No more have come through the Q&A pod, but if you do come across a question after the webinar, please feel free to email the speakers, and most speakers will do their best to get back to you, and you can also contact us, and we can do our best to liaison with the speakers to get back to you. We've already gave an opportunity to go to the phone lines. If you do have a question, just press *6, and I'll stop what I'm saying and let you ask your question, because that's why we're here. I'll just remind you that you can contact the presenters via email, and if you And I think we've had an opportunity to get to all the questions online, but if you didn't, we will be sure to forward it to the presenters. And finally, I want to thank all the presenters to today. Susan, Patricia, Deborah, and Greg, you all gave excellent presentations. We had a lot of information that was presented to us, and it's exciting because we can follow the CHEER program and we can follow the Center for Causal Discovery as you guys move forward with each of your grants. If there's no more questions at this time, we conclude the webinar. You can contact the presenters via email, as I mentioned, with any questions that you have. And their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN, which is linked from the webinar webpage. And also, each of the presenters indicated that they have respective websites that you could also keep up to date with. Again, thank you to Susan, Patricia, Deborah, and Greg. I thank you for taking the time to prepare and for sharing your presentations with us. This concludes today's presentation, and thank you again for all the great questions and your participation.